Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Under attack, apparent Russian shelling of schools in northern Ukraine highlights the heavy toll the war is taking on children and on families who are being torn apart.
That we are not together, that our family isn't together. This is very difficult. We're used to being together all the time, and the war has separated us.
Then a critical shortage. Parents nationwide struggle with a lack of baby formula caused by a recall and the ongoing pandemic. And it's Friday. Jonathan Capehart and Gary Abernathy weigh in on the president's push for more COVID funding and on the January 6th committee's decision to subpoena Republican lawmakers. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Wall Street finished another bad week with a good day as investors picked up bargains. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 466 points, 1.5%, to close near 32,200. The Nasdaq rose almost 4%. The S&P 500 jumped 2%. For the week, however, the indexes fell between 2 and 3%. After nearly 80 days of fighting, Russian forces are still trying to break through in eastern Ukraine. The Ukrainian army says that it turned back two attacks in the Donbas region today. Meanwhile, the European Union announced another $500 million to help Ukraine buy heavy weapons. We'll return to the war after the news summary. U.S. basketball star Brittney Griner will spend another month in pretrial detention in Russia. She's been held since February when Russian authorities said they found cannabis oil in her luggage. Griner appeared in a Moscow court today. Her attorney said that he hopes her trial will begin soon.
Today, at the end of the investigative actions, the pretrial detention was extended for a month, which means that we can expect that the final charge will be brought soon and the case will be sent to court.
If convicted, Griner could spend 10 years in a Russian prison. The U.S. State Department says that she was wrongfully detained and that it is trying to win her release. South Korea today offered medical supplies to North Korea to help control an apparent COVID-19 outbreak. And Russia said that it will consider any North Korean request for vaccines. On Thursday, the North's state media reported that at least six deaths had occurred and 350,000 infections with an unspecified fever. In Jerusalem, violence erupted before the funeral for Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh. Israeli police charged and beat mourners outside a hospital, and pallbearers nearly dropped the coffin. Police said the crowd disrupted the agreed-upon funeral plans, chanted nationalist songs, and threw rocks. The incident drew strong reactions from the European Union, at the United Nations, and in Washington at the White House.
We have all seen those images. They're obviously deeply disturbing. This is a day where we should all be marking, including everyone there, the memory of a remarkable journalist who lost her life. We regret the intrusion into what should have been a peaceful procession.
Abu Akleh was killed Wednesday covering an arrest raid in the occupied West Bank. Witnesses say that Israeli troops shot her. The Israelis say it's unclear. In a new raid today, an Israeli commando was shot and killed in a gun battle with Palestinians. Back in this country, Elon Musk is delaying his plan to buy Twitter for $44 billion. He tweeted today that the deal is, quote, temporarily on hold, pending details on whether spam and fake accounts really represent less than 5% of Twitter users, as he wants. That estimate affects the company's value and its selling price. Musk tweeted later that he's still committed to the deal. Former National Security Advisor Robert Bud McFarlane has died after suffering a lung ailment. He was heavily involved in the so-called Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan presidency. It involved selling arms to Iran with proceeds going to anti-communist guerrillas in Nicaragua. Ultimately, McFarlane was the only White House figure who voluntarily accepted legal blame. Robert McFarlane was 84 years old. And Queen Elizabeth made her first public appearance in weeks amid speculation about her health. She attended the Royal Windsor Horse Show today, arriving by car and then walking to her box. Earlier this week, she had missed the opening of Parliament. The Queen is 96. Her 75th anniversary on the throne is next month. Still to come on the NewsHour, how an image of a black hole at the center of our galaxy marks a new era for space science. Former presidential advisor David Gergen discusses his new book on leadership. We remember some of the 1 million Americans lost to this ongoing pandemic, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
For the first time since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin spoke with his Russian counterpart today, calling for an immediate ceasefire. That's according to the Pentagon. Nearly 3 months into this war, much of the focus is now on the eastern Donbass. But there is also a southern front where Russia made early gains. The fighting continues in the Kherson region, and as elsewhere, stuck in the middle, are families struggling to stay united. Nick Schifrin reports from southern Ukraine.
At a center for families who fled their homes, the kids are all right. 9-year-old Kirillo, his younger brother, 8-year-old Andriy, and their baby sister in the pink sweater, 6-year-old Anna. The city created this play area the day the war began. The clothes they wear, the toys they play with, the stuffed animals that line the shelves, all donated. It's not home, but it's a safe space where boys can be boys. And even sit down when their mother Lilia tells them to.
How are your children doing these days?
They're fine. Thank God. At first they were stressed, but then they got used to being here and now feel fine.
They feel fine thanks in part to the center's psychologist, Lydia Kortyanova. She uses drawings to measure a child's trauma.
Children mirror what their parents feel. If the parents are worried and anxious and show that, children reflect it.
The parents arrive in Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown from nearby villages needing everything and are greeted with bags of food, racks of clothes, and boxes of shoes organized by size. Alexander Vilkil was appointed mayor after the Russian invasion. In a side room, they sing a song of longing, missing the homes from which they fled.
What are they fleeing from?
The IDPs who come here are running from hell. The information we receive from people in occupied territories, executions, torture, and rape are the standard practice. Today, the Russians behave themselves worse than Nazi Germany during World War II.
That's what Lilia and her kids feared, but her husband had to stay behind.
I'm very worried about him. But we have no way out of this situation. I don't know.
And how difficult for you have the last few weeks been?
That we are not together, that our family isn't together. This is very difficult. We're used to being together all the time, and the war has separated us.
We decided to try and find her husband. We traveled 30 miles south, down rutted roads. The Ukrainians bombed the nearby bridge, so the only way in is across the Inhulets River. On the other side is the Kherson region, parts of which Russia still occupies. And waiting for us, Lilia's husband, Stanislav. Stanislav and Lilia both grew up here in Zaradivka. Before the war, it had 800 residents. Today, no more than 30.
A woman was killed in this house. She was in her yard and the Grad rocket hit there, and she got killed.
In mid-March, Russian troops in red seized the city of Kherson and pushed right to the edge of Zakhrativka. They lobbed artillery, and Ukrainian and Russian soldiers traded small arms fire. A Russian shell flew through the roof of the school auditorium that 3 months ago was full of children. The family's farm is down the road. This is where his wife grew up, where they moved in together after they married, the only home their children have known. As a couple, they've never spent more than a day apart. Stanislav wants to show me the reason his family fled, the Russian rocket that landed in their backyard.
And where were you when it landed?
It was in the evening, approximately at 7 p.m. I heard the sounds of the Grad rocket, and I shouted.
The wall between the impact site and the house where the kids were eating now pierced by shrapnel.
I haven't seen them for a month. I don't have gas to go and see them because the gas stations are empty, so I can't go there. Immediately, the day after the attack, I took them out of here, and they haven't been back since.
In the middle of the property where the family was forced to hide.
This is the cellar.
It's actually a food storage turned shelter with a child-sized makeshift bed in the corner. They could always hear the fighting above.
The bullets whistled by here. It was scary. We got really scared for our kids.
He's collected all the shrapnel that littered the farm, some of which landed just in the last few days.
So this is your home.
And inside the house, past the window broken by shrapnel, is his children's room, the bunk beds Kirilo and Andriy have shared since they were born, and their toys mixed in with Anna's, untouched for a month.
It was always noisy here, and now it's quiet.
Tell me about the future. What do you hope for your future and for your family's future?
I hope the victory will come soon and that our family will be together again. This is my dream.
But for now, it is a dream deferred and a family that remains separated. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Shiffrin in Zarahtivka, Ukraine.
So hard to see. And a note again that our coverage of the war in Ukraine is supported in partnership with the Pulitzer Center. The shortage of baby formula has grown into a major challenge for parents all around the country. Today, President Biden defended the administration's response, saying that his team responded as soon as it understood the problem, although it began months ago. When pressed on whether he could have acted more quickly, the president said, quote, "If we had been better mind readers, I guess we could have." Allie Rogan looks at the latest, what this administration is doing and how parents are coping.
Judy, 40% of formula is out of stock in stores nationwide. That's a 20-fold increase since this time last year. Supply chain disruptions, inflation, and a recall by one of the biggest producers have worsened the shortage. Parents are struggling. Here's some of what they told us.
The baby formula shortage came to my attention a few months ago when there was a big recall of a lot of the formula products that we use for our now 7-month-old. And we switched to a formula that was really popular, very common, which made it very easy to find online, virtually any store that we went to. But today, with the shortage, it's actually become really competitive.
I do feel like the shortage has been heightened as we are over here in Puerto Rico. So not only do we have the shortages showing up on the shelves, but also the transit time for new formula to arrive on the island has been extended.
Having a hormonal disorder, I haven't been able to produce as much milk as he needs, and so I've been supplementing with formula. The formula shortage has greatly impacted our family and given us high anxiety because without it, we wouldn't be able to feed him properly.
My daughter was on the standard formula that you should be able to find very easily in stores, and we weren't able to. It was just completely empty shelves, so we ended up taking the financial hit and signing up for the subscription formula.
I'm sending out family and friends, especially those living in other states, telling them to keep an eye out for the particular brand that we use and the type that we use.
Right now, we're working on getting my friend from Canada to bring down the equivalent of the formula that he takes, which unfortunately is only one.
I've been paying a lot more to get my formula than I normally would. So on top of the formula cost itself, I'm paying for the flat rate shipping through the post office because they treat Puerto Rico like a state. Whereas if I have a formula being shipped by UPS or FedEx, They actually treat Puerto Rico as international shipping.
Hopefully for all of us, formula will be more abundant in places, especially rural areas where people cannot, you know, go to cities or access supplies via the internet. In the meantime, there are lots of mom groups online that you can join and contact. And people like me have been posting where we find certain formulas.
Sometimes it seems like when we're not getting support from the places where we should be getting it, moms are there to help each other. And that's really powerful. Moms really, I think, keep the world going. I think we could solve any problem. I think we should be in charge of the world for a few days, see how much we get done.
The White House announced three steps yesterday to address the shortage. It said it would urge states to expand the options for parents receiving federal WIC benefits to buy baby formula. The president is also asking the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, and state attorneys general to crack down on price gouging. And the FDA will take new measures to increase imports in the future. Joining me now is Brian Dittmeyer. He's the senior director of public policy for the National WIC Association. WIC serves about half of all infants born in the United States. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. We just heard from parents who are really struggling to access and afford formula. What advice does the National WIC Association have for parents?
Well, we know this is an extraordinarily stressful time for parents, and we keep hearing stories of parents who have to go five or six stores before they find a can of formula. And so some of the advice that we have is around mitigation strategies. So, you know, identifying where in your community there's supply. It could vary because this is a highly localized issue. And so it may be the store one day, a couple weeks later, it may be the food bank. But I think an important piece to also be mindful of is, you know, to avoid risky infant feeding practices that could lead to long-term health consequences for your infant. So stay away from homemade infant formula recipes. Do not dilute your formula and do not introduce cow's milk before year one.
The White House has been under pressure to do more, especially since this recall that triggered the shortage happened 3 months ago already. Do you think the White House has done enough?
I think the White House has been leading a great interagency effort from day one of this recall. And while there's a lot of steps that have been taken, a lot of steps that are going to be taken in the next couple days, I think one of the most concerning pieces of this is just how highly centralized the infant formula marketplace is. There's only four companies that command about 90% of the domestic infant formula supply. And so we need to take a look, a hard look at this industry and ask ourselves the question of why did we let one plant closing for a food safety issue for a couple of weeks result in this level of disruption to the marketplace and to the consumers for such an essential product?
Absolutely. Now, as we mentioned, half of the nation's infants received WIC benefits. Prior to this shortage, WIC recipients could really only access one brand of formula, depending on what state they're in. I understand that some state WIC programs have already taken steps to expand those options. What have they done, and what additional effect, if any, will this announcement that the White House put out yesterday have?
It's really a curious question, why we allow WIC families to only have access to one brand of infant formula in the first place. We know that there's a number of steps put in place to expand the brands and the container sizes that are available to WIC customers. Really, I think one of the messages coming out of USDA consistently through this product recall is we have to take every flexibility possible to make sure that the WIC consumer is treated like any other member of the general shopping public during this recall.
But to be clear, many of these states have already expanded this eligibility, right? They did that shortly after this recall was announced and these shortages began to manifest themselves.
I think that, you know, it's been a holistic effort here. And so USDA has been working from day one to enact what flexibilities exist. But one of the pieces we recognize as well is that the program was not necessarily built for this moment. But we also are really focused on the market consolidation. And I think that's the concerning factor here, because the WIC program could use whatever flexibilities it has. It could use flexibilities that are built into it. But if we do not have a resilient supply chain moving forward, then we're not going to be able to serve the need of all infants in this country, but particularly infants in low-income families.
In terms of expanding access to imports, which the White House has also said it wants to do, what options are there given how stringent U.S. regulations are?
I'm excited to see what FDA announces in the coming days, but we recognize that historically infant formula in this country has been manufactured domestically, and it's largely because of the FDA rules around product safety. If there's one lesson that we've learned throughout this product recall, it's that we have to put the safety of this product first. And I think that as we explore what flexibilities exist as far as imports, we need to be mindful of keeping that guiding principle of both safe but accessible infant formula for all of the infants in this country.
Brian Dittmeier with the National WIC Association, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
For decades, scientists have believed there is a black hole at the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way. Yesterday, for the first time, they released a photograph of it, an astonishing sight. Its shadow is surrounded by light that is being bent by immense gravity coming from the black hole. And it is just about 27,000 light years away from Earth. Miles O'Brien is here to explain some of the mysteries around all of this. So, Miles, tell us, what is the significance of this image?
Judy, it's our black hole. You know, we've seen a picture of a black hole before. The same team delivered a picture of a much larger black hole, M87, in 2019. But this one is at the center of our galaxy. And while it might look kind of benign there, there's a lot going on there. The gas is spinning around that black hole at impossibly difficult speeds to comprehend. It has a mass that is 4 million times our sun. And the researchers were saying that as they were looking at it, they could see it moving in minutes' time. They described it as burbling and gurgling. So it's a crazy place to be. If you and I were there at the edge of that black hole and set foot in it, we would be spaghettified. So it's kind of a mean place in our galaxy, kind of a tough neighborhood, but important for everything that is around us and makes us who we are.
How were they able to get this image in the first place?
They have a telescope the size of Earth. So I know that doesn't sound logical, but basically what they did was they connected 8 telescopes all over the planet in pairs and made sure they took observations at exactly the right moment, synchronized with atomic clocks. And then what they did was they compiled all that data, collated all that information, and then used an algorithm to sort of fill in the gaps. So it's kind of like, you know, you can imagine a piano keyboard with some keys missing. If you can fill in enough of those keys, you can figure out the tune. And so basically they figured out the tune using computational techniques that had never been done before. It's quite an amazing accomplishment of engineering.
And for the scientists, Miles, what makes this so important, so fascinating to them? I mean, do we worry about Earth getting sucked into this black hole?
No, we're in a safe neighborhood. Don't worry about that one. But it is fascinating for a couple of things. First of all, this is probably the strongest proof yet of Einstein's theory of relativity, which goes back to 1915. He theorized that these things existed. And then for the longest time, we looked and looked and didn't see them. In 1974, scientists found the spot where it was likely to be. And now we have finally seen it. And so that gives us this amazing validation of a scientific theory, in addition to being pretty darn cool on top of that. The other thing that they found that was interesting is that it matched in many ways the image of M87, the other black hole that they imaged. It has that same donut pattern. So that tells them that what they saw initially was not a fluke, not just a coincidence. And now they say they've seen an extraordinary big black hole in M87, and now they've looked at ours, and it's kind of a more run-of-the-mill black hole.
And so now that these scientists have this, Miles, what's next? What do they next want to do?
Well, we've got the selfie. Up next is the movie. They're going to try to expand the number of telescopes on the surface of the Earth. so they can have another opportunity to image this black hole and others in greater detail, enough detail to capture the motion. Basically, that the time exposure was long enough that the motion around it, the gas that was spinning around that black hole, was blurred. It's just like shooting a waterfall on a time exposure. So with a few more telescopes on the surface of Earth, they should be able to freeze the action, as it were, and create movies. And then maybe someday, they hope, we can put interferometers, these kinds of paired telescopes, into space, which would be, of course, much farther apart and which would create a much bigger lens virtually. And who knows what we'll find then.
Miles O'Brien, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Judy.
David Gergen is known to many viewers of this program as a longtime Friday night commentator on the NewsHour, but he's perhaps best known for his role serving as a senior advisor to four American presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. I spoke with David earlier this week about his new book, Hearts Touched with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made. David Gergen, welcome to the NewsHour, and congratulations on the book. There is a lot to ask you about here, your advice for young people, but I want to get to the headline, which is telling older people essentially to get out of the way. I mean, you actually say it's time for people driving the bus to return the keys.
Well, I believe that. But first of all, Judy, thank you. I feel very much like I'm coming home, being with you like this. Listen, I think that it's very clear now that the generation that was ruling a couple of generations ago, the World War II generation, did a terrific job. We will always look back at them as sort of the role model, the gold standard. So they gave the baton to the baby boom population, the generation, many of them being the parents of the baby boomers, obviously. And frankly, as there are many good people who are baby boomers, they're very fine public servants, but as a whole, the generation has been a disappointment. By contrast to the World War II generation, which left behind an America that was the strongest since the days of ancient Rome, culturally, militarily, economically, contrast that with the legacy of the baby boomers. Crisis upon crisis that we haven't solved, actions we haven't taken, you know, there's a real growing sense now that the path we're on is unsustainable, and we have to get back to being strong like the World War II generation.
And what would that mean for the two men who are the most powerful in our country right now, President Biden and former President Donald Trump, who is, by all accounts, likely to challenge him?
Well, I do think that, you know, as much as we don't like to talk about age is an issue if those are the two nominees, because we would have Biden and Trump, one of the men would win, and that winner would becoming president with what is the hardest job in the world, with health which is unreliable, and a vulnerability that is out there, and potential weaknesses. I think it's inappropriate, and I think people like Biden and Trump ought to both step back and open the door to younger people from the next generations to serve as president. We just can't take the risks that are involved, and especially on health.
And we should say President Biden is 79.
Yes.
Former President Trump is 75. If they did step aside, David Gergen, there would be a free-for-all.
There would be.
Each political party. You could be looking, I mean, there are any number of scenarios, but you could be looking at a match, say, between the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, and, say, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts.
Well, of course.
What would that
look? You know, it may sound unfair to say Biden or Trump ought to both step back, but I think for the good of the country, that's what's needed. And by the way, it would be healthy if we have a Donnybrook among a number of different candidates with different perspectives. We should welcome diversity in our politics. You know, so I don't think we ought to be afraid of it. I think we ought to see it as something that's appropriate in a democracy when, you know, this is one of the best. The office of the presidency is the most complex, but yet the most powerful, and it requires a keen sense of judgment. And I just turned 80, and I can tell you, you lose a step. You're not as sharp. You're more forgetful. You're not quite sure where you're going. You can't. That's too old to be in the presidency.
Well, let's apply this to the Congress.
Sure.
Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, is 80 years old.
Yep.
But she shows no signs of slowing down. In fact, she's given credit right now for holding her party together in ways that, you know, members of Congress say there are few others who could do that. Would it be better for her to step aside, even if you didn't know who could take over the Democratic Party right now in the House?
Well, you remember a couple of years ago, she said she was going to step down now. And she wasn't afraid of it. She's been a little less obvious since then about what her intentions are. But both she and Senator McConnell, who is also 80 years old, I think it's important that people not be clinging to power, but yet trying to nourish and improve and help the younger generations. And we have some splendid people in those younger generations.
So if it, even if you're saying, even if it leaves chaos.
I don't think it leads chaos. I think it's an orderly transition to the next generation.
As you look around the country today, who do you see as potential leaders of promise?
Sure, thank you. I think there are two streams of people that I see. One is made up of veterans who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and I've been involved in efforts to persuade some of them to run for office on both sides of the aisle, and that is beginning to take hold. There are some wonderful people now in the Congress. Some of them are going to be vulnerable in this midterm election because they do come from purple districts, and so we'll have to see what happens. But I think overall, they impress me so much. They're just like the World War II generation. I'm a big fan of some of them. They're not all terrific. You know, there are a lot of people who are millennials, you know, who are seen as arrogant and difficult and just they act as if they're entitled. But there's another stream I want to mention, Judy, which is less noticed, and that is people of color who are coming together, especially black women. Mm-hmm. They have taken the moral high ground. And they with the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter. I don't agree with their politics or the left of me, but I celebrate the fact that they're out there in the arena working for change.
Last question, sure. David Gergen. How many of these baby boomers and even silent generation like President Biden do you expect are going to take your advice?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be resistance. I have no doubt about that. You've got to plant a seed and raise the question.
The book is Hearts Touched with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made. David Gergen, thank you.
Judy, thank you.
As the United States marks 1 million deaths from the pandemic, President Biden has asked Congress to approve new money to fight future coronavirus variants. That spending has been stalled for weeks. Meanwhile, Congress' January 6th committee issued subpoenas to five Republican lawmakers. And that brings us to the analysis of Capehart and Abernathy. That is Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post, and Gary Abernathy, a Washington Post columnist. David Brooks is away tonight. Hello to both of you on this Friday night. Very good to see you. The subject is grim. You won't be surprised to know. But I do want to start, Jonathan, by asking you about where we are on COVID. Here we are at a million deaths. We are all incredibly sobered by that. We're hearing from the experts that there could be another, 100 million infections, or I'm sorry, 100 million infections coming. And the administration is saying we need between 10 and 20 million dollars, billion dollars, to deal with COVID. Are there good arguments against that?
No. Can we just pause for a moment and understand we have lost 1 million Americans. I don't know what the particular folks on Capitol Hill, what other evidence they need to see for why that funding needs to be passed. Think about just how much pain and death and agony the American people have suffered. Not just the 1 million people who died, but their families and loved ones and colleagues. There's going to be another variant. For the United States not to be, to do everything possible to be prepared for that moment, to do everything possible to forestall another 100 million infections, that would be dereliction of duty. In March 2020, we had no vaccines. We didn't know what this was. Everything was shut down just to try to stop this virus, this thing from spreading around. We know so much more 2 years later. We've got vaccines, we've got boosters. Why on earth would we not do everything possible to ensure that we don't go back to those horrible days 2 years ago?
Gary, what is the argument? Republicans are resisting this funding. What are the good arguments not to give it?
Well, it's hard to come up with good arguments not to, you know, offer a life-saving vaccine. But when you talk about what happened 2 years ago and how it happened, you've got to remember we took a one-size-fits-all approach to fighting this thing nationwide. And I know, you know, communities that got a tremendous influx of COVID money and couldn't figure out how to spend it all. I mean, it was kind of a, let's just throw a lot of money out there. And you know, this is not a Republican or Democrat criticism. Donald Trump was a part of this. Donald Trump was approving these things, too. Republicans and Democrats did this. And now some people are kind of starting to say, well, wait a minute. Where's our priority list? Where is this on President Biden's list of priorities? Is it above Ukraine? Is it above helping more with more money for Ukraine? Is it more important than the Build Back Better program? Is it more important than forgiving student loans? Maybe. To me, I think, you know, providing these vaccines is. But at some point, we get to a point where this money doesn't exist. We don't have this money to spend, really. And so I think people are asking, you know, are asking the president, hey, come up with priority. And I think he does have a plan that says, okay, now we're going to prioritize people. We're going to provide vaccines maybe to just the most at-risk people, people 60 yeah. and over, yeah. people with immune issues.
What about the argument, Jonathan, that some of this money was spent and it's not clear where it went, or it went sure. in other directions?
Sure, but that's not an argument to do nothing. You do better the next time. But the idea that because some money went somewhere it shouldn't have gone, then we shouldn't prepare and protect against a future variant, I think is ridiculous. Also, you know, this idea of, you know, more money for Ukraine, I wrote down politics because folks are playing politics with money for Ukraine. And it's clear why that money is needed. Yeah, it's for Ukraine, but it's really for the fight for democracy. So some of the same folks who are complaining about the COVID money are some of the same people who are complaining or stalling, you know, funding for Ukraine. This had when it, to bring it back to COVID funding, the administration and basically Washington cannot not do anything, cannot not prepare for what's to come.
Gary, how much of this is politics and how much of it is based on real, legitimate argument?
I mean, in Washington, all, how much hello, is politics?
I know.
All of it. But, you know, even on Ukraine, the Associated Press a couple weeks ago, and PBS highlighted it, I think, talked about there's coming a point where how much can we give? I mean, everybody wants to help Ukraine. It's the most worthy cause. But we're depleting our own resources. There's real questions now about our ability to defend ourselves against a North Korea or an Iran if something were to happen, because, you know, there's only a limited supply of these things. So people are starting to now take a look and say, look, we'd love to do it all, but we have to start prioritizing and figuring out, because really this is money that just doesn't exist.
Yeah. And of course, Ukraine, we don't know how long that's going to go.
Right.
I mean, the predictions are it could be months, even years, is what we were hearing this week. The January 6th committee, they've issued more subpoenas, Jonathan, this time to five House Republicans. Mm-hmm. One of them is the minority leader, mm-hmm. Kevin McCarthy. He's indicated he's not particularly excited about going. But what does this lead to? I mean, these high profile, well, asking for their own membership to come and testify.
So let's keep something in mind here. When someone is subpoenaed, that's an extraordinary step. And when that person is a sitting member of Congress in an investigation into an attack on the Capitol and an attack on American democracy, that is a serious step. But it's not the first step. The first step was asking House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and some of the others to come in voluntarily and do their duty as a member of Congress, but also as a patriot, to come in and talk about what they know and to help fill in the gaps, to help, that committee and the American people, by extension, to understand what happened on that day as a means of trying to prevent it from happening again. They refused. And so the fact that they're being subpoenaed, yeah, it's an extraordinary step. I think it at 100% should have been done. It needs to be done. The attack on the Capitol was an attack on the American people, an attack on our democracy, and we need answers.
How do you look on these subpoenas?
Yeah, I agree 100% that we need answers, that what happened on January 6th was one of the most horrible things in our nation's history. And I think we've already had a lot of answers. I think answers are coming in many ways, including through law enforcement with the people who are charged. One thing that I know a lot of people are worried about is conflating the peaceful rally that day with the riot. In other words, there's a lot of talk about, well, who did you know? Did you help plan this rally? Did you help? And planning the rally was perfectly fine. Okay, it's the hundreds, a few hundred that broke off and actually invaded the Capitol that are being prosecuted. But I think the committee does risk some partisan suspicions. If it doesn't, it depends on what it finds. I think that people have already made up their mind about whether this committee is going to uncover anything without a bombshell revelation. If this committee comes up with and says, you know what, here's a bombshell revelation about what was really behind this and what the intent was, and it kind of rocks the whole world, both sides of the aisle, that's going to be one thing. But short of that, I think people have kind of already settled on their talking points and what they're going to come out with at the end of the day when this thing eventually wraps up.
Well, you do have committee members saying there is eye-popping, big information to come from what they've discovered.
And I hope it's eye-popping. But I also hope that the information, even if it's stuff that we already know, even if it's stuff that we've read about, that we've listened to with some of these audio recordings that we've listened to, that we not become numb to the seriousness of the information that we're getting, and that it is important that an investigative body with subpoena power and the ability to write a report, to put on hearings for the American people to see, to bring in witnesses, to show them what people were doing, what people were saying, how this thing got planned. And yes, we need to know how the rally got organized and then how some of these people went to the Capitol and ransacked the Capitol and tried to attack our democracy. I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that even if we've read some of this stuff on the front page of the Washington Post or we've watched news reports here at PBS NewsHour, that it's not important.
The fact that it's almost a year and a half later. Yeah.
Well, here's what we do know. The rally happened, and what we know is bad enough. Donald Trump stood up at a rally and said, if you don't fight for your country, you're not going to have a country, and basically pointed him to the Capitol, where his own vice president was overseeing the count of electoral votes in a constitutional process to certify this election for Joe Biden. I mean, that's bad enough. How much more do we need how much more bad things do we need to come out to say, for enough people to say, Trump's responsible for what happened?
It would be helpful if House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy would tell the American people what he told the president in those moments. It would be helpful if Jim Jordan, who wants to become the next, Judiciary Committee Chair in the House, what he said to the president when he talked to him probably multiple times that day. That's important for us to know. This is not a partisan issue. This should be a patriotism issue. Our country was under attack, and it could happen again, which is why that commission, that select committee, is in place to do this report.
Yeah. And his point is that there's maybe culpability on the part of some of these members.
Yeah, and again, there's a fine line. And again, you're talking about your fellow members of Congress. There's a fine line between saying things to try to, we know a lot of those conversations that were happening through what's been leaked were to try to get Trump to take action, you know, to calm things down, to put an end to this thing. And who knows what they said to try to appeal to him and his ego to make that happen. But would it be interesting? Yes, I just think that a lot of it's being found out in other ways, and the committee just needs to be careful when it comes to subpoenaing members of Congress. Republicans are going to control Congress very likely, after November. And, what goes around comes around, and you just got to be careful how you treat your fellow members of Congress.
They've already said that if they come into power in the House, that there are going to be investigations galore. The White House is already preparing for that moment.
So. And that's not, we need to back
back off from those vendettas.
Carrie.
On this Friday night, all right, yeah. We thank you both. Jonathan yeah. Capehart, Gary yeah. Abernethy, thank Thanks, you very Jerry. Much, both of you.
Thank you.
With COVID-19 now claiming 1 million lives in the United States, we want to pause to acknowledge this moment and to remember some of the Americans who lost their lives to this virus since the pandemic began. 61-year-old Quincy Sim, a correctional officer at New York's Rikers Island, was known for his calm demeanor, great sense of humor, and hard work ethic. When he contracted COVID-19, Quincy called in sick for only the second time in his 18 years on the job. He was a mentor to the basketball players he coached, neighborhood school kids, and his six-year-old son, Aiden. Patsy Yasukochi was the heart of her family-run bakery in San Francisco. She knew her customers by name and often their orders by heart. A proud mother and grandmother, Patsy displayed family photos on the bakery walls and loved taking silly Snapchats with her five grandchildren. As a young girl, Patsy's family was imprisoned in internment camps during the Second World War. Her daughters say that experience gave her the perseverance she would later rely on to battle cancer. She was 80 years old. Arlene Saunders was as captivating as her soprano opera voice. Born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, Arlene spent most of her career in Germany, performing with the Hamburg State Opera on stage and on television. She would go on to sing at the biggest opera house in the world, the Met. Down to earth and elegant, Arlene moved to New York in 1986, where she married the man she loved to dance and sing with, Raymond Raskin. Arlene was 89 years old. Barry Weber was a Renaissance man, a New York City surgeon, who could build cars and computers and also loved the ballet and classical music. His wife, Harriet, says he was quiet and mysterious, but confident in the emergency and operating rooms and a great teacher. He shared his love for rock climbing with his two boys, Duncan and Michael. Barry was 67 years old. Margie Kidd was in her 40s when she went back to school to become a teacher. She had a gift for holding the attention of her kindergartners and first graders in Ridgeland, South Carolina, and regularly said that learning should always be fun. She'd wake up early by 6 a.m. each day and send silly memes to her daughters and grandchildren, along with messages of love and advice.
Just remember what I taught you to become a better woman. You must believe in yourself, you must do better, and you will must help others.
Margie was 71 years old.
Though I never saw them at all, there was you.
Freddie Perez de Tagle loved to sing, whether it was in his church choir or just answering the phone, his son told us. He moved from the Philippines to Toledo, Ohio in his 20s to be with his wife, Priscilla. A dedicated grandfather, Freddie loved the outdoors and camping. He also had a lifelong interest in fashion. His family said he took pride in choosing what to wear every day. Freddie was 67 years old. Melvin Greenagle lived a long, full life of music, service, and family. Raised on a farm in Metamora, Illinois, he played tuba in the U.S. Army Band during World War II and was the last living member of the band that marched under the Arc de Triomphe on Victory in Europe Day 1945. After the war, Melvin married and settled in Arlington, Virginia, where he continued to play music for the U.S. Army and raise a family. His granddaughter told us he was a calming presence who embraced the quiet moments and in retirement loved nurturing his grandchildren, basset hounds, and many plants. He died at age 103. Mary Beth Nolan's parenting and teaching philosophy was to let children learn by making their own choices and mistakes, her family said. She applied this when homeschooling her three children, then as an elementary school science teacher in Houston, Texas. Mary Beth was also a lifelong learner, her sister said. At 50, she gained a master's degree in educational technology, and she was instrumental in transitioning her school to virtual learning during the pandemic. She lived with chronic pain from rheumatoid arthritis, but never complained, her daughter said. Mary Beth died 2 weeks before her 60th birthday. 77-year-old Rosalind Knox was the backbone of her family and trusted confidant for many others, her son said. Born in Ohio, Rosalind grew up in Colorado and played violin in the All-State Orchestra. She moved with her husband, Sylvester, to military bases he was stationed on across the country and globe. Eventually, they settled in Tacoma, Washington, with their two children. Faith was central to Rosalind's life. She volunteered at her church for decades and founded a Christian nonprofit focused on connecting women with the gospel online. Yvonne Brown loved poetry and believed in the power of literature, friends and her family told us. She shared these passions in her classroom as an English teacher at Parkland High School in Prince George's County, Maryland. Yvonne also volunteered for the Toni Morrison Society for 15 years and wrote a novel about a young woman growing up in a fractious Iranian-American family. She lived life loud, a friend told us, and wanted her daughters, Samira and Layla, to be confident and comfortable in any setting. She was 44 years old. Salvador Ortiz, known as Cano, was warm, funny, and selfless, his daughters told us. Cano grew up in a large family in Puerto Rico, then moved to Lorain, Ohio, with his wife, Julie. He worked at the Lorain City Water Department for 3 decades and also did odd jobs as a handyman to support his family, his daughters said. Cano loved the Cleveland Browns and bonding with his 7 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. He was 68 years old. And we want to thank all the families for sharing your stories with us. Our hearts go out to you as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic. And online right now, we have more on the tragic COVID milestone, including why it's so hard for us to comprehend the true scale of the lives lost. You can find that at pbs.org/newshour. And tune in tonight to Washington Week, where I'll be filling in for moderator Yamiche Alcindor. The panel and I will discuss the congressional deadlock on COVID funding and how abortion rights could factor into the midterm elections. That's at 8 p.m. Eastern here on PBS. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us each night this weekend and here again on Monday. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.